My name is Tommy Andrews and welcome to the SoundSpring podcast. This is the place where creative musicians share the ways in which they turn their stories, ideas, and feelings into sound. During each episode, my guest composers will take you on a guided journey through one of their musical works. This is music, straight from the source. Hello listeners, and welcome to episode 12. This week we have the creative force that is Pete Latanka. Pete came onto the scene after graduating from Leeds College of Music, forming a trio and releasing his debut album Afrostocracy on the award-winning Zephyr label, garnered a great deal of positive press, and all the while he had started working for the Children's Music Workshop, and subsequently his education work has inspired people from all ages, backgrounds and genres. Pete's versatility and vision sees him facilitating composition in youth offenders institutes, creating jazz ensembles with primary school children, working with professional orchestras and opera houses, and working with street children in India. Pete enjoyed 3 years as the artistic director of Oldborough Music's Group A and 5 years as a music director of Glyndebourne Youth Opera. He is an education ambassador for the National Youth Jazz Orchestra and a trustee for the St. Albans Cathedral Music Trust. I started playing and educating with Pete through Ed Barber's Blues and Roots Ensemble, and I knew that I'd found a kindred spirit when it came to sharing the expressive powers of music. I rarely meet people who possess such boundless energy and enthusiasm. Pete truly is a treasure and a force for good in the world, so please welcome the extraordinary Pete Latanka. Hi, Pete. Thank you so much for joining us on the SoundSpring podcast. It's an absolute honour to have you along.
Absolute pleasure to be here.
We are going to be talking about your composition called Hope and Glory. Firstly, can you tell us who is performing in this recording?
So these are 1,000 young people from up and down the UK. And it was the closing part of the Music for Youth Proms that happens every year in the Royal Albert Hall. And the way the Music for Youth is set up is they have, I think it's 4 sort of trials, and you work your way through different trials, working up different sized venues. So you'll work in your local area at a sort of big school or a town hall, and then you'll go come to one place, which might be Birmingham Symphony Hall or somewhere. And then you just work your way through the through the stages. It's not a competition, but you're given advice by panels of professional musicians in various different parts of the industry. And if you keep going through and you keep going through to the next round, the final round is you come to the Royal Albert Hall. And so you've got a huge range of people performing completely contrasting music. So you'll have a folk group, you'll have a punk group, you'll have a heavy metal group, you'll have a jazz big band, you'll have an orchestra, choirs, etc., etc. And my commission was to draw all of these 1,000 different performers to do something together.
And did they tell you exactly who you were going to expect there on the day, and then you just had to create this bespoke arrangement from that?
No. So, well, I knew that I was going to have an orchestra, because each night they balance the programme, because it's set over 3 nights at the Royal Albert Hall. So each night you've got a completely different group of young people, but each night what they have is an orchestra and a big band. So I knew I had that, and then everybody else, whether they were in folk bands or whatever, I actually used them as a choir.
Now, this commission from Music for Youth, did they specify what they wanted you to do, or did they come to you and say, we want you to write something for the closing of the Music for Youth at the Albert Hall, and then you were given the kind of artistic freedom to come up with an idea?
Yeah, so with like every other prom, up until that point, they'd been ending with Land of Hope and Glory. And this was the first year that they wanted to try something different. And Judith Webster, who's the CEO of it, is a really extraordinary woman with amazing vision. And she just said, look, I want to do something different that really celebrates these young people. I don't want it to just be a flag-waving thing, which has always felt slightly at odds with what we're doing, which was this sort of promotion and celebration of youth rather than a promotion and celebration of history in the past. And so she just said, yeah, can you make something that will bring everybody together? And that was literally the brief I got.
Now, I have the privilege of watching you work in workshops and education projects. Even though you're very well known for your kind of electric jazz performances across the UK and internationally, you're an incredibly talented educator. And I was wondering, did you always see education as a part of your career trajectory, or did you kind of fall into it?
No, I think I fell into it. I had basically started playing piano at the age of 4 or 5, and it was a classical training. And my father, who's from South Africa, and was a doctor, but also played the piano. So I spent a lot of my very small baby years sitting on his lap, plonking things out on the piano. And in South Africa, they do everything through the sort of the solfège, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do system. So, and that gives you the ability to play in every key because you're thinking in numbers rather than notes. And so he always had this ability to be able to improvise. And he wasn't a jazz musician in any way, shape or form. He was absolutely obsessed by Bach and was really steeped in all of that stuff. But he had this ability to improvise. So I would sit on his lap constantly and improvise with him. But because I was doing that, I really struggled with learning to read music. Because I think the music I was given to train you to read was less engaging or less interesting and possibly less sophisticated, without sounding conceited, than the music I was making up with my dad. And so partly I really struggled with that. I think there are things done on music dyslexia, which I'm not dyslexic with written word or text, but I could be musically dyslexic. I don't know, in that when I am faced with sheet music, my brain gets flooded. And my understanding of dyslexia, which might have completely wrong, is that you look at the letters rather than the shapes of the word. And I feel like when I'm looking at sheet music, I'm still saying F-A-C-E, all cows eat grass. I'm still trying to work it out letter by letter. My brain just isn't great at recognising shapes in that way. And so it was a real struggle with my classical training, and I was... And improvisation was always my sort of saving grace. And I also realised I loved 20th century harmony, I loved non-European rhythms, and I loved improvisation. So I was always a jazz musician. And I think at about 15, I was right on the verge of stopping playing piano because I didn't know what I could do. I didn't really know much about jazz courses, and there weren't that many in 1994, I think, 93. Sorry, this is a really long answer to a very quick question, but I'm getting there. I discovered Leeds College of Music, and which was the only place at that time you could get an undergraduate jazz degree. And I think having graduated through all of that, and went my way through that afterwards, I left college and I went to Brighton, and I lived in Brighton, and there my friend who was at Guildhall said, look, why don't you come and look at this programme we're doing, which is called PCS, which is Performance Communication Skills, and every person who's doing the classical courses at Guildhall, undergraduates, had to do an element of PCS as part of their degree. So he'd said, come along and see what we're doing in London. It's amazing. And I was always interested in education. And finally, there's your answer. I was interested in education, but I hadn't realised it was going to become so key and fundamental to my career. And I think the struggles that I had with education, with music education, you know, like so often we're trying to give ourselves the chance that we didn't have, and you give it to other people. And I think that's probably a big part of my decision to spend some part of my career in education was to sort of rectify my education and hopefully give people the education I wanted.
You've already discussed how your father came over to the UK from South Africa, and I was wondering whether you would mind sharing how you feel that maybe your career as a composer and educator may have been shaped by your heritage.
So I think, first of all, it's a really interesting one about identifying as black, and I feel like this year has thrown up so many things for me, and my brain is really scrabbling to deal with it. And I feel like I'm not clear in any way, shape, or forms about all of these things in a way that I haven't really thought about it as deeply as I've had this year as a big sort of part of this BLM movement. But my concern instantly is about this term black. And this is slightly getting away from the music, but it really ties in, really, because I really struggle with binary. I really struggle with binary terms. Mm. And this isn't to shut down the conversation, but I wonder whether the language, if we're going to really get out of this cul-de-sac that we're in with the kind of dealings with race, I suspect, and I don't know, but I wonder whether we need to update and upgrade our language. As has always been done in the 60s, James Baldwin, Malcolm X, all of those people were writing about, they used the term Negro, which was the term in sort of 60s America, and then it kind of evolved into American Negro, and then it sort of, people thought this was too, it evolved again to coloured, and then it evolved again to black, and that's where we've got to, and it hasn't shifted since whenever, 80s, I suppose. And I wonder, it's such a nuanced, complicated thing that requires so much rigorous sort of breaking down to understand it. I just think using simplistic terms and binary terms like black or white isn't the... I don't know whether we're going to have success in this. And 20 years ago, I lived in America and I went down for this Million Man March in Washington. We were marching against the beating of Rodney King. So 20 years later, to still have these marches fills me with despair, and I'm trying to work out how can this be the last march that we do, and I don't know whether it will be using these terms. So my terminology, which I'm playing with, is whether people are shades of brown, light brown, dark brown. And this is the fact, right? We're not black or white. Race is, of course, a social structure, not a scientific structure. And actually, by taking out the bulkheads, you broaden the story and also expose the ridiculousness of it, because you're talking about the truth, which is we are all different shades of brown.
Thank you so much for sharing your views there. And though I can't speak from any kind of personal experience, I can definitely see where you're coming from with the use of binary terms and how it kind of places people in these camps that maybe don't make them feel like they've been seen or that they are appreciated.
I guess the thing is, like, I'm always trying to find the B-side of a record or a cassette tape or something. I'm always looking at, if, you know, like a scientific experiment, like this vaccine that we're working on, you have to test it in different scenarios and different settings. And I always think, okay, so take about the other thing that dominates sort of British culture, in English culture maybe, is class. And I always think about that thing of how much, if we take out race and try it with class instead, and does that, you can see it, but does it give you anything besides noting the shade of pigment? I don't know what else it gives you if you suddenly start talking about people's class as a way of kind of describe them. And I suppose, you know, I think about when I hear all the time about black music, and I never know what that means. Like, I just genuinely don't know what that means. When I hear all those sort of South African players playing jazz, when they try and play it like Americans, black South Africans playing it like black Americans, I always just feel like they totally... Sorry, I just feel like they slightly mess it up. It doesn't swing in the same way. It's because it's a totally different language. And so, when you're trying to say, when people talk about black music, it's as vague and as non-descriptive as talking about white music. Yeah. You're talking about sort of Galician horns or Alp horns or bagpipes. You know, what is white music? And I just think, again, all these terms are, I feel like the software needs to be in line with the hardware. And we're updating our hardware is constantly being updated in terms of our brain's ability to deal with things. But if the language, which is the software that you're running on that hardware, is old, you've basically got you're not living to the full of your capabilities.
Yeah, well, thanks for sharing all those views.
But just to say about how much that influenced my music, sorry, which was your question, is profound. And, you know, my father's, as I say, a black South African from a township called Sophiatown, which was one of the forced removals that happened in the 60s, where the South African government at the time bulldozed this township because it was close to Johannesburg, and it was a place where people of all shades, black and white, were meeting. And, you know, nothing demolishes a system like apartheid more than people actually meeting. And so it was. So we had a lot of forced removals, and my father and a lot of his friends went into exile out of South Africa. And as a kid, I grew up with people always coming. We were about 20 miles north of London. So whenever people would come from South Africa to promote something, they'd always stay with us because we were just outside London, and so they would come and stay. So we had this table. Hugh Masekela would be there. We'd have Ellen Kuzweyo, amazing writer. We'd have Zakes Mackay, an extraordinary actor. We're doing stuff with Marlon Brando. We'd have Desmond Tutu come. We had this extraordinary table in our dining room, and it was always filled with people sitting up late trying to discuss how you bring about democratic change without resorting to the levels of violence that the South African government were imposing on South Africans at that time. And after they'd discussed all of this, they would sing these sort of protest songs. Not protest songs, childhood songs as well as protest songs, I suppose. And it was their way, because they were in exile, because they'd been forced to leave because of political views, it was their way of connecting with their home. So I would go to sleep and I would hear underneath Dad playing the piano, Hugh Masekela playing the trumpet, whoever, Miriam McCabe, somebody would be singing. And this music would just come up and I would hear it and I would fall asleep to it.
Wow.
So I absolutely had, that was my music side on my father's side. And my mother's side, my grandmother, who is English, set up the Aldborough Festival with Benjamin Britten and had a very different life to to the South African group. But what they both faced, which I think really left an impression on me, is the danger of regressive views. And my grandmother said that when they had a lot of struggle setting up the Aldborough Festival, and when they chose finally how it was going to run, there was a lot of resistance from the local community, particularly around Aldborough, where it was eventually set. And she said the night before the very first festival, one of the ladies of Aldborough called her up and said, "Fidelity," it's my grandmother's name, good Quaker, virtuous name, "Fidelity, I think you don't understand, and I want to appeal to your sense one last time. What I don't think you understand is Aldborough has its sailing set and its golfing set. So please don't bring your long-haired friends here." And all the long hairs were Aaron Copland, Benjamin Britten, you know, W.H. Auden. And so I think from both sides of my family, I've had an interesting thing of music being a refuge and a rallying call to escape regressive views.
Wow. I think I could talk to you for hours about all of that stuff. This is just incredible, the names that you're pulling out there. So the original poem that accompanies the Pomp and Circumstance, The Land of Hope and Glory, It glorifies the might and influence of the British Empire. It venerates bloodshed. It praises the acquisition of territory. It's full of paradoxes, like there's a line, "the mother of the free," which is quite jarring when I hear it, because obviously a lot of the empire was built on taking away people's freedom through slavery and colonialism. For someone in your position, considering that events such as the last night of the Proms are kind of promoted as representing this bastion of Britishness and what it is to be British, how does it feel to hear those lyrics and see all of those people singing those lyrics?
Yeah, it's a funny one. I feel the thing about that, I think the funny thing with me is I'm constantly moving between worlds, and I always have done. So that description I was saying of my home life, of having the South African community with this kind of my Suffolk life, which are all sort of, you know, posh English people, and I was sent to a pretty rough school in Hemel Hempstead, I was always moving between those worlds. And I think with that, I've never belonged to any single world. But I also appreciate and understand that if you do belong to a single world, it's really powerful to line up with the flag and be tight to the flag. And I've never experienced that. I've never understood it. I've never supported a football team. I've never done that. All of those moments where never been a part of those moments. And I think I absolutely recognise that how powerful it is to feel a part of something bigger than yourself and something that includes and protects and nurtures your family. I think that is extraordinary. I just wonder whether there's this idea of updating the software. Just because I feel there's so many opportunities that get missed if you spend too much time looking in the rearview mirror, or your future, and all the promise that that brings.
There's recently been quite a bit of tension surrounding the performance of the original Elgar piece at the Proms. Did you yourself feel any kind of pressures when you were revamping the original? Or did you feel like you had complete freedom?
No, Music for Youth gave me complete freedom. And it was my choice to link it to Land of Hope and Glory. Because I think that thing again of recognising that it's not what I want to do. I don't want to just walk over somebody and say, you're wrong, I'm right, the past is bad, the future is better. I don't think you change anything by banging people on the head. You know, there's a nice Churchill quote where he says, diplomacy is the ability to tell people to go to hell in such a way that they look forward to the trip. You know, not that I'm telling people to go to hell, but I think that thing of you can bring people round to a new view without bashing them over the head and without making them suffer for it. And I think what I wanted to do, because it was the very first time that they hadn't played Land of Hope and Glory, that I wanted to make it quite close to it. I wanted to honour it because, I mean, the piece is beautiful. The piece is so powerful. I get why it is so moving to people. And so when I was sort of tackling it, I wanted to refer to it in many different ways, and as many ways as I could.
Through education, you and I get to work with thousands of incredible young people, and we get to see their potential and unlock their talents. And I feel like sometimes there's this kind of prevailing attitude towards young people that they can't possibly have had the life experience to have valid views or opinions about these kind of important matters. However, your piece and your lyrics, they place a huge emphasis on the young as our sort of standard bearers with this vision for our future. Was your piece or your lyrics in any way influenced by views that have been expressed to you by the young people that you work with?
Yeah, so I spent a lot of time in the sort of whatever it was, 9 months, I guess, 6 months, 9 months, when the commission came in to the performance date or before, you know, to scoring it, going up and down the country and just talking to young people about what they thought about the piece, about what they thought about the Elgar. And what they all said was that we love the music. The music gets us, but it's the words that always feel odd. And interestingly, that Elgar himself was really disappointed with the words because he felt that they reminded him of war. So that all that kind of bombast, he was slightly saddened by. But also what came out was this idea that they weren't interested in looking back on glory days. And it wasn't politics, it's not left or right or whatever, right or wrong. It was, they just thought it was, as I say, more interesting to look forward and to look back. They felt was somehow, some people, not all of them, but a lot of the young people felt like there was it made them look pathetic, but not pathetic in the old-fashioned use of the word, of being, you know, something to feel sorry for rather than something to feel proud of, right? I remember one girl that was, they were so sweet. Somebody said, look, I feel like a teenage boy said, I feel like an old man. I feel like an old man who's lost his hair, standing on a beach, boasting about how much hair I had when I was young. That's what this song makes me feel like. Somebody else, a seven-year-old girl, said to me, look, I don't feel like I want to go travelling around the world on a boat telling people how to live their life. I mean, the last time I was on a boat, I got sick. So we had these beautiful sort of responses to it. But what was clear was that the Elgar they had no problem with. It was just this, it was the fear of looking like you'd lost something rather than you looking like you're finding something. And, you know, I think back to that thing about gathering tight to the flagpole at 2012 at those Olympics. Again, as I say, I've never been able to fit comfortably or easily or by myself into a single group. But when I watched that Olympic opening ceremony on TV, I was in floods of tears because I just thought this is such an extraordinary, confident country where the Queen is in on the joke of jumping out of an aeroplane with James Bond and then landing and walking. I mean, the celebration of, again, I don't feel it's political. I just think it was a country that had the courage to laugh at itself, a country that had a way of looking back at its past without shame, but with remembrance and with, you know, that thing of being the past informing the future rather than needing to block it or to run away from it. I just felt a really, really confident country. And I think in the years up until Hope and Glory, that confidence seemed to have been eroded. And I think the young people I spoke to also felt that, and which is why they really wanted to push this confident look towards the future.
When you were reimagining the music, what elements of Elgar did you want to retain? I mean, there's one for me that sticks out in particular, which is in the original, there's that big leap up to the minor seven leap in the tune.
Well, remind me, where does that bit go?
Yeah, sure. What key is it in? D major. This might get quite high for me. Da 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 dee, da da da
yeah.
Da da
yeah.
But in your tune, I really like that you've got a big major seven leap because it's almost like a slightly brighter outlook.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that was conscious or subconscious or whether you were maybe just being like, well, I can go one better. I can go a semitone higher than you. were there any other things in there, like little Easter eggs that we can listen for?
For that opening part particularly, I wanted people to have in the back of their mind a little trigger that said, ooh, this reminds me of something. And I think it might be, it doesn't sound so familiar. It's not so jarring to be waving my flag at the Albert Hall without hearing Elgar. And the idea of doing it interval leaps and pushing and being leaping further than Elgar wasn't on my mind.
Oh, okay. So musically, when it kicks off, it hits the ground running with this really kind of cinematic sound. Were you consciously trying to bring the sound into the 21st century?
Yeah, I think I really wanted something that grabs them. And I wanted something that... So when I lived in America, what I loved about the Americans' approach to jazz was this thing that just grabbed you by the collars and said, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're doing. And it was felt so different to the kind of haunting quality of some of those sort of ECM recordings. That Oscar Peterson thing where he just says, we're going on this. You're going to love this. And I really wanted to create something like that, that was fantastical and big and bold and a powerful statement to get people to sit up and realise that this isn't Elgar, but this is something big.
The introduction serves almost like an overture. It contains most of the themes that appear later on. And it's instrumentally really, really challenging. And as I mentioned before, there's this thing sometimes with the approach of educating young people where they're not necessarily given... they're not sort of given the belief that they can really tackle these harder things. And you've written something that's actually pretty, pretty difficult. And it feels like a real message of intent. It's like, look at us, this is what we can do. and we're not messing around.
Yeah.
Straight off the bat.
Yeah. And I think everything I do, that spirit informs everything I do. And sometimes I come unstuck with it, and sometimes I wish that I could play, I could tread a safer, easier, more a path that I've got more guarantees with. But there's something in my nature, in my character, that I just don't know how to do it. I can't do it. You know, there's an interesting thing of like, in the Islamic tradition, you weave a stitch of imperfection into your prayer mat to show that there's nothing greater than Allah. And I think that sort of that thing of, I find that idea, it's not that I'm wanting to do a stitch of imperfection, but I never want to make something easy. I can't see the point of making something easy. Something that's been done before, something that you know you're just treading in the footsteps that are in front of you, I'm bored by. I've always been bored by, which is why I've always loved improvisation. But also that thing about putting things just in front of people, there's a nice, that Victorian poet Robert Browning, who says, "Ah, but a man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for?" And I love that idea that, right, you've always got to be going for something just beyond where you are. And I think that is such a beautiful, inspiring and human place to be.
So the first verse sets out a lot of your new lyrical ideas, and there's a real focus on the words unified, side by side, and dignified. Were these themes expressed to you by young people? As you said before, you were going across the country and asking people about the piece, or were these themes things that sprung into your head without that influence?
I think it was a real mixture. I know that, you know, the original text of saying wider still and wider shall our bounds be set. I think I've forgotten what
that's correct.
Yeah, so, and I wanted to keep it quite tight to the flagpole. So I wanted to change the lyrics to this idea of this song that's being created, that is going to be this vision of these three really strong elements of unity and dignity and standing side by side and support, that this could be this piece that is shared, and we send this wider and wider into the world. I mean, what a torch to carry into the world. I really recognised, I think that thing of dignity is, I really see it in the South African community that I was sort of brought up in, which was, I think in South Africa and during the apartheid years, there was so little dignity for people, or for black people in South Africa. And what was so important to them was dignity. And so again, hearing those discussions, that was the word that kept coming up. So I think partly informed by the kids, but also me bringing to the table this thing of allowing, giving people their dignity is so important. I think I sprinkled that one in.
The introduction and the first verse feature some slightly darker cadences to the ones we get near the end of the piece. And I was just wondering whether this was a conscious decision that maybe is kind of beneath the lyrics. There's musically, you're telling us that maybe some of these issues are still yet to be resolved.
Yeah. And I think I wanted to contrast the glorious opening, which is so bombastic and, you know, flourishes and fantasy, that I was wanting to hint at the idea that this is that transition, I suppose, from this is the fantasy in the introduction. When they first sing the first verse, this is actually what we're setting out. And that's the kind of, that's the pledge. That's what we're trying to achieve. That's the intention. And then when we divide into our three pieces, that's showing how it can work. That's showing how you can have three things that are independent and integrated all at the integration and independence all at the same time. just to prove it, just to show it. Take away the band and listen to what it sounds like when you have three totally different melodies working together and creating these sudden, surprising explosions of harmony. But I think before that point, I needed something that was not somber, but something that was that had gravitas, so that you took it seriously. It wasn't just a fantasy.
When we get to the second verse, you introduce the rhythm section and the intensity ramps up, the groove kicks in. Did the piece kind of develop naturally into this, or when you decided you were going to revamp this piece, did you immediately think, right, I'm going to revamp Elgar and there's going to be some groove in it?
Yeah, and I'm a sucker for people clapping on 2 and 4. It gets me every time. I never get tired of it. So I wanted an opportunity for the audience to do that, because I think that's just how you get an audience for that type of music involved. I wanted to make something that was for people, that was not only for the performers, but was also for the people listening. And I really wanted to involve them in some way, just to take them on the journey. So no, I was absolutely any excuse to try and get them clapping on 2 and 4.
Rock and pop music, there's no way it would exist in its current form without African music having travelled across the Atlantic as part of the slave trade, essentially, and creating forms of music like blues and jazz and things like that. Is there a part of your thinking here, like a broader message, that is by combining Western orchestral music with this rock and pop, are you showing us that really we're more beautiful when we just work together?
I feel like it's the opportunity that I want to show. And as I say, as a kid, I grew up with moving between these worlds of the South African community living in exile and hearing all their politics. And I was at this school which was didn't have many opportunities for the kids there. And also I had these cousins and family in Suffolk who were, you know, our English aristocrats. So I was always moving between these three really contrasting worlds. And I feel like I always felt like all of those three worlds by themselves were lacking. You know, my mates at school who all we talked about, and I loved it and I know everything about ninjas to this day, is from chatting with my mates about ninjas through my teens. They knew nothing about South African politics. The South African politics knew nothing about pheasant shooting, and my posh cousins knew nothing about whatever, ninjas and South African politics. I feel like I'm always wanting to show what I've always found interesting, which is simply diversity of thought. There's that book, The Reader. I've forgotten who wrote it, but there's a brilliant line in it right towards the end where our heroine is trying to it's a Holocaust book, and there's a bit where she's trying to sort of make amends and atone and trying to make sense of it. And she says, you know, I'm trying to find a lesson. What can I learn from this horrific Holocaust so that it never happens again? And a Holocaust survivor says, you can't learn anything because nothing good comes out of this. This thing was so bad that nothing good comes out of it. And it's such a powerful statement. And I'm really wary of searching for good things that have come out of the horrors of the transatlantic slave trade. But I don't know whether I feel that there might be the potential of something good. And that being, as you say, rhythms from West Africa finding a fusing point with harmonies from Europe. And the fact that that meeting point did create something exciting, brand new, flavours had never been heard before. And... and that being sent out into the world. And so now, of course, jazz that's made in Beijing sounds completely different to jazz that's made in Oslo, which sounds completely different to jazz made in Rio de Janeiro. It's sort of, you know, every culture sprinkles their own flavours into this continually evolving soup. And I think, yeah, I'm always looking for handshakes because I think handshakes give you really interesting moments.
Enter now into this double time section, and as you mentioned before, you introduce these numerous vocal themes and they come in one by one and then you piece them together. And as you said, I think your terminology was that you get these flashes of harmony, and it really reminds me once of when I was doing this workshop, and even before I'd got to the workshop, and I'd stated what I wanted to kind of things I wanted to achieve, and part of that was getting these primary school children to sing in three-part harmony, and they told me straight off the bat, they're like, you'll never be able to do that. and that kind of fired me up even more, obviously. But a really good way of doing that, which is what you've done here, is teach them essentially three songs that have really, really strong thematic melodic material. Don't tell them they're going to sing in harmony, because suddenly they'll kind of clam up, and then just say, right, you sing that tune, you sing that tune, you sing that tune, put them together, and you've got kids, young people singing in three-part harmony.
Yeah. I mean, I, and again, you know, it's funny doing it in this way, because I use that technique a lot in my workshops for just the same reason that you've said, which is just, I love harmony, of course, and it's such a brilliant way of getting them in. It's the sort of backdoor techniques, like the magician who's pointing at an empty palm, but you realise the coin is in the fist that's part of the point. But what was interesting is when I'm doing it as part of a workshop, I create it in a way of having two chords and a really strong harmonic centre. And then they compose something separately in maybe different spaces or far away from each other, so they're not influenced by each other. And then what's always extraordinary is because they're creative, they've made it independently of each other. When it comes back, you have those extraordinary moments of, you know, dissonance or real or sort of, you know, extraordinary harmony. But what was different about this thing is it not happening, they're not being the reveal of it to me, which is what happens when I'm doing it in a day in a workshop. That actually this was me sitting, teasing this melody, teasing these melodies around, adapting the words constantly, adapting the melodies, trying to find that glorious moment when they're singing Hope and Glory, where it suddenly breaks into that sort of those sort of gospel harmonies, and it was like doing a maths equation, you know, just this constant balance, and then, you know, that being changed, then trying to reharmonize it in such a way that it's not obvious, that you don't get the reveal until you're ready for it. And also knowing that these guys, these young people are going to be having to sing it, whatever, 12 times, and trying to make it fun enough for them to sing it 12 times without losing energy.
Now,
The first theme returns again, but instead of having the groove or the more kind of stately feel to the orchestral verse one section, we get these big homogenous chords. You can see when you watch the video that the guys, especially in the brass, are just absolutely tanking it. It's an incredibly powerful moment, and I pretty much burst into tears every time, especially on the big interval leap, gets me every time. Is there anything significant about this section, you know, on the kind of the level beneath the lyrics?
Yeah. Well, you know, okay, so if we've come from this fantastical start, this fantasy, this film, this is augmented reality, you know, this is our intro. We go to a verse which has its somber moments. It sets out soberly, this is what we are trying to achieve. It goes into the fantasy of three parts of saying, and this is how it could sound. Listen to what happens when people work in harmony. And then this ending declaration, which is to be able to say, knowing this, what do we do? How do we do this? This is our vision. This is how we do it. Which is why on the first verse, where it says unified, dignified, side by side, it's quite quick. It moves quite quickly. And on this one, I wanted to really underline it. It was that thing again that it's the Oscar Peterson grabbing them by the collars and saying, you've got to listen to this. This could be extraordinary if we tried it. And I wanted to make it, yeah, I wanted it to be this march to the future that says all of this could be waiting. We have the potential for something, to make something extraordinary. And rather than look back to the past and for comfort, and we look to the future with hope and glory. I mean, boy, there it is.
You can really tell that the young musicians are playing and singing with so much passion, like it's the last gig they're ever going to play. What can we, as seasoned musicians, learn from this, and how this is often achieved in these kind of youth music situations?
Well, this is what really surprised me about this, and why I'm such a sort of great advocate of music for youth, is because when, you know, I'm there from sort of 8 in the morning till we perform at sort of 9 at whatever, 8 at night, 9 at night. And I hear, I have this extraordinary moment of just listening to all of these groups who have, as I travel from across the UK, and I just hear them rehearse. And I sometimes sit, you know, in this huge auditorium and listen to them rehearse. And if I close your eyes, you think you're listening to the London Symphony Orchestra or the Berlin Philharmonic. You feel like you're listening to people who have been working and crafting and learning and developing their skills for 30 years, for 20, 30 years, you know. And then you open your eyes and you look, and there are sometimes little legs swinging underneath the chairs. They don't even touch the floor. I mean, again, you know, it's that Robert Browning poem. It's that thing about the grasp and the reach. There's something in young people performing that actually goes beyond technicalities. And those technicalities, if they're not, yeah, it's the reach. I think that's the power of it. But also, and you know, I think often, because as professional musicians, we've got one eye on our mortgage payments, we've got one eye on our bills, we've got so many other things that we're having to balance, that it's really hard to give ourselves completely to the music, because we've got other things going on in our lives. Not to say that young people don't, but I think the baggage feels possibly bigger, heavier for, I don't know, I'm not sure about this. But what I do know is that if you look at sort of on the stage and you see somebody playing Juliet and Romeo, or Romeo and Juliet, and they need to be whatever it is, 14, 15, 16. And if you see a 30-year-old playing Romeo and Juliet, it just doesn't, I never buy it. It just feels like bull. It just feels rubbish because the cynicism and that kind of wearing down that we all have of, you know, worn down by the hammer on the anvil of time, right? So we've all got those things, and the energy and the positivity and the for so many of them, I think these pieces sound best performed by young performers. There are so many pieces that I think they bring to life in a way that a seasoned pro 20 years older can't.
When you're doing these kind of projects, is there something that you yourself get in return that's unique amongst everything else that you do?
Yeah, I think it's that. Because, sorry, so it feels like I'm just constantly talking about myself, but it's such a personal thing that it's hard to talk about dispassionately and without talking about yourself. But I feel like what resonates for me is when I see young people responding to music, because all those things, those divides, those bulkheads that people like to put in life, whether it's on race, whether it's on class or gender or sexuality, whatever, all those things. And I just feel like if you can lift them up for a bit, there's this common humanity that so often gets forgotten. And I think seeing young people, anybody, I mean, it doesn't happen, it's just anybody, but I find it fascinating because sometimes, you know, if you're at a club and the DJ does a big drop and the whole room is, boom, it comes to it. Yeah, that feels so powerful. And then suddenly when you see it, kids feel that same energy. And you, for me, I just see the shared humanity, right? I see that thing of, my God, age doesn't even divide us. I get that you have a similar response to me. My daughter is one, and I love watching her dance. It sort of chimes the same bells in me. Whenever there's music, when the doorbell goes, she starts bouncing up and down. As soon as she hears music, she just moves, and I'm like, well, yeah, that's what we as human beings have always done, and it soars over politics and geography and all the other bulkheads that people put between us.
In another 100 years, do you think someone else will be asked to update your version?
I'm counting on it. I so hope they do. There's a brilliant Muhammad Ali thought where he said, a person who thinks the same thing at 40 as they did at 20 has wasted half their life. And I feel like everything that we create today, I so hope that the software gets updated. You know, I want my kids to have a different approach and views and politics and values. I feel like there is, you know, there's that great line, Obama used it, and I think it's been used before, that says the arc of moral history is long, but it favors justice. And as long as there's a curve in this thing, I hope that in the future they will completely change it around. I don't know how, but I'm counting on it.
So I've been asking all of my guests some quickfire questions, and so now it's your turn to run the gauntlet. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
The best piece of advice I've ever been given was given to me by this extraordinary jazz pianist who I studied in Maine, in America in 1996 for a year. And I won a scholarship to go and study with this guy who informs every part of my life, not just music. And he basically said, your mistakes are the least interesting thing you're going to do today. So don't polish them up, get over them, do something interesting now.
What's the biggest lesson you've learnt that's maybe due to something not going quite as you'd planned?
I think that for me, every time I'm free from the binary of right and wrong, I have become a better musician. The moment I make a mistake, I'm free. And not that I want to make a mistake or welcome them, but I step over them and then I'm free. There was this old movie, not old, there's a Robert Zemeckis film called Contact, based on this book by Carl Sagan, amazing science fiction book. And in it, the aliens send people this sort of a sphere which allows them to travel through the universe and meet them. And they get the plans, but in the plans, it's just this sphere with nothing in it. and all the people at the space, the kind of European and NASA and whatever, they say, we need to put a chair in this thing. And people are saying, well, there's no chair on the planet. And in the film, which is a great film, our heroine is in this sphere and she's dropped in and she's going through wormholes and the chair is violently shaking and it's blurring, she can't speak, it's kind of, she's losing her mind, and then suddenly the chair breaks free and suddenly she's floating in the most graceful, peaceful way in this sphere. And for me, that the binary of getting it right or getting it wrong with kind of music is that chair for me. And the moment I've got it wrong, it's broken free, and then I'm at my best.
Is a floating piano stool on your rider then for your gigs?
Every gig I have.
Do you have a particular piece or maybe an album that you think you'll probably always go back to, and it's just something that you won't tire of?
It's a piece, but actually, oddly enough, it's I don't know if this is cheating, but it's really the one piece that's been reimagined, which is Joni Mitchell's Case of You. And I think, you know, I think she recorded it in 71. And then that album she did in 2000 with Vince Mendoza. And I think that piece, that 30-year gap of hearing her, you know, when she was sort of, her voice is up the octave and she's sort of young and earnest and, you know, and then suddenly it's this woman who's lived for 30 years singing the same thing, and suddenly the gravitas of lines that say, you're in my blood like holy wine and you taste so bitter and you taste so sweet, so I could drink a case of you and still be on my feet. And it suddenly feels so different. And I think, again, that thing of moving to the future and not being stuck in the past and what the gift of progress brings, that to me is the soundtrack of that.
In your opinion, what makes a great composer?
I think the ability to respond and react to the time you're in and what's happening around you.
Is there a particular musical moment you can give us that gives you the biggest rush of emotion or goosebumps?
Okay, so this would be, sorry, it's slightly two, but it's the same feeling in both, which is Miles Davis, It Never Entered My Mind. I think it's the part two one. It's the slower version. Red Garland, I don't know whether, I'm trying to work out whether it's on the Working, do you know that? Whether it's on the Working album, it's Prestige. Anyway, I think there were two versions of it. And when he does it, there's this split note that he goes for, it's a leap. Oh, God. It makes me, like, choke up when I'm even talking to you about it. It kills me. And also there's William Walton, the soundtrack to Henry V. And there's a piece called Touch Her Soft Lips and Part, and he does exactly the same thing, where he does a big leap. And those jumps, again, you know, it is this reach and the grasp. And the fact that Miles splits that note is that beautiful balance between the reach and the grasp that, it makes my heart bleed.
You can ask one composer anything. Who would it be and what would you ask?
Now, this is a really tricky one, because I think that there are so many things that have been explained, right? We know pretty much how our iPads work, how 5G works, how you can get to Mars. All these things we're pretty good at explaining. And there's, I think, the last few bastions of magic on Earth are in music. And so I would be really reluctant to ask any composer anything, particularly the ones I really admire, because I want it to remain magical. In that opening to Hope and Glory, and I was thinking, how does John Williams do those kind of flourishes that kind of accentuate the feeling? And then just sitting down and scoring it out and thinking, oh, so it's just going up and down a scale with a couple of semiquavers. And it was so, like, that feeling has always made my heart break when I'm listening to E.T. flying off or Superman, whatever, you know, and to realise, damn it, all we're doing is just semiquavers pretty fast up and down. It was so, it took the magic away. So I think, as narrow-minded and possibly not uninterested and uninteresting it seems, I think I wouldn't ask them anything.
Which composer would you bring back to life in order to see them react not only to today's music, but also maybe to the way their music is being played today?
That would be fascinating. And I would bring back any of the old school Europeans. I'd bring back Brahms, I'd bring back Beethoven, I'd bring back Bach, I'd bring back Mozart. I would love those guys to see what music, how music was being performed, where it was performed, and who was listening to it. I'd find that fascinating and work out what they felt about that and whether they felt, I don't know. I wonder whether they would feel that it's been hijacked. I wonder whether they would feel that all the patrons that they were writing music to flatter and to make the rent and put food on their family's tables were suddenly a huge part of the audience making the decisions on where, when and how it's played. I wonder how they would feel about that. I wonder whether they would feel like, are you still playing it like this? Are you still playing on these old instruments? I mean, there are these amazing synths now, you could do all this digital stuff. Why are you still playing on, you know, horsehair? You're crazy. You know, I feel like all of those guys, all of those composers have been looking forward. And I wonder whether they would think, whether they would feel slightly surprised that we were still playing that.
I agree, especially composers like Bach and Beethoven, I think, who were just such musical mavericks. I feel like, and I also feel that way maybe about Charlie Parker as well. Just like, what would he think? What would he think to hear that people were just still playing like him, at the jam session at Ronnie's? Would he be angry? Would he be like, guys, like, come on?
Yeah, exactly. And I'd love to hear what Louis Armstrong felt. I wonder, you know, that him saying, I don't like to hear all that Chinese music when he's listening, he was so baffled by bebop. And I wondered what I'd love to hear his take on music today. But also, you know, in the opera world, I would love to hear, because I do a lot of workshops with opera houses. And what I'm constantly struggling with is the young people I'm working with love the music, but the duration, they find it just goes on for so long. And, you know, in the 1980s, when there was that real thing of adverts and, you know, Ridley Scott and all those, Alan Parker, all those amazing filmmakers making the most incredible, punchy, neat adverts that lasted 60 seconds and you told a story in 60 seconds. And, you know, when I'm seeing these teenagers look up at the surtitles at the Royal Opera House and the surtitle is said for the last 2 minutes, but I love you, but I love you. And they're like, yeah, I get it, but I love you. I got that, but I love... And I wonder whether they would say, you know, you could neaten this up a lot. You know, and like Sondheim and all that stuff. I love Sondheim stuff. And, you know, he tells such deep, vivid, complicated story. Even Hamilton. I mean, I've only seen it once. But I mean, that thing of being able to tell a pretty dry story like the formation of America's fiscal institutions and systems. To be able to do that, Lin-Manuel Miranda, to be able to take you through 60 years of pretty dry subject through a rap in 16 bars is amazing. And I wonder, all those old composers, whether they'd think, just do it quicker.
Speaking of bringing Beethoven back also reminds me of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, where they bring back Beethoven and they lose him and then eventually find him in a synthesizer shop just shredding on all these keyboards.
Exactly. I mean... I really feel like that's what they were doing, because they weren't, you know, they were constantly updating the instruments. They weren't, you know, I mean, I love what the things like the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment are doing by playing on period instruments. I think it's interesting to hear how it would have sounded at the time of the composer. But I just, you know, it's that thing again of keeping the software in line with the hardware. And I just think in that case, you can update both. Get, you know, don't play on these old winded clarinets with sticky valves and all that stuff, sticky buttons, whatever, keys. you know, just get the best instrument possible. I don't know. I wonder.
So let's imagine a hypothetical situation where I'm coming to you with a blank check and I'm saying you can do any project that you would like. What would you do?
If it was really blank, then do you know what? I would try and put jazz at the heart of the curriculum in education. I think I'd put it at the heart. Yeah, I'd put it at the heart of the curriculum. I'd put it in everything, because I think all those lessons that we've discussed about collaboration, about not being in a state of adversary all the time. I think that thing of the benefits of collaboration, the benefits of sharing. So you're not holding so tightly onto something. You know, there's that Thomas Jefferson thing where he's talking about, he was like the third American president, talking about slavery. He said it's like holding a wolf by the ears, that it's too dangerous to let go and it's too dangerous to hold on. And I feel like the system that we've got now is that we've got a wolf by the ears, but it's a lot less dangerous than we think to let go. And I think that thing of letting go is to be able to share better, to be able to realise that by sharing and by collaborating, I mean, this sounds earnest, but it really feels real to me, that the possibilities for mutual benefit are enormous. And I think that thing of jazz just demonstrates it by its being.
You can go to any concert or gig, rehearsal, recording session in history. What would you go and see?
I would go and see them recording Kind of Blue. I'd be fascinated, you know, when they re-released it with the second take of, I think it's either Flamenco Sketches or Blue and Green, I've forgotten which one. And just hearing fascinating, just the variations on those improvised solos that feel, you know, this, we've all listened to it so many times, it feels like a theme. And to hear the variations on the theme, I'd be fascinated to have heard, to hear all that.
Now, you may have already answered this one before, but what would you put in place to make music education veer towards, or a little bit more towards, creativity and storytelling, self-expression, allowing young people to get what's inside into sound?
I think it's that trinity of musicianship that I misunderstood, I think, from Benjamin Britten, which is that to be the full musician, rounded musician, can you be rounded out of a triangle, forgive my geometry, but to be part composer, part performer, part audience. And the audience is being aware of who you're playing to and how you engage with them and being informed by them, which is, for me, is why I do this education work. And I think that, you know, the danger is that if you're educating people musically simply just to read the dots, that's all they'll ever be able to do. And if you're teaching people to simply improvise or without dots, they're never going to be. It's just so much harder to be able to take on somebody else's ideas quickly and neatly. So I feel like that thing of take away no binary and move between those three positions, which I always feel all the best musicians have always been, which is composer, performer, and audience.
And just to finish things off, can you just let us know how we can keep in touch with what you're up to, and maybe if you've got any exciting projects coming up in 2021 that we can check out?
Yeah. So I've got a band that I started about a year, maybe 2 years ago, called the Cape Crusaders. And it's quite an early band, and I'm still really working on the sound of it. But it's set up to kind of share and celebrate the music of Abdullah Ibrahim, South African jazz pianist, through sort of recordings and performing and education work. And we have done a really interesting project with the South Bank Centre last year, which we're hoping to repeat, which was taking 250 kids from across the borough of Southwark, from the hardest to reach schools, and creating their own. The young people created a response to Abdullah Ibrahim's life, informed by themes of apartheid, unity, legacy, the ability to change religion, transformation, all of that stuff. And that's on my website. I think that can be seen. So my website's petelatanker.com, and I've started to post some clips on Instagram of the concert. So that's a quite fun thing to see these young people doing amazing things. But also, I've been amazing talking about meeting your heroes. Last week, I spoke to Abdullah Ibrahim, who I've been listening to since I was a kid. And I've spent a year basically trying to get this film I made of this South Bank show to him, so he could see what the children had made of his life. And I'd spent a year, and it just ended up in cul-de-sacs and dead ends, and finally I got it to him. And he wrote back that afternoon saying, we are moved to tears, just sort of beyond words. And I mean, so I've been, and then I've been Zooming him. And I mean, boy, I spent 3 hours talking to this man who feels like one of those last few people who have walked with the gods of our religion. You know, it's like, you know, he talks about, you know, we're talking about building a brand and what we can do together in collaborations for 2021. And then he'll suddenly say, you know, when Duke Ellington would talk to me and he'd say, you know, when Duke Ellington would talk, if he wanted to really for you to pay attention and knowing he was saying something important, he'd just pick a bit of lint off your jacket. And the detail of that, it's like, oh my gosh, it's like someone saying, you know, Norse gods, it's like someone saying, you know, Thor really grumpy in the morning, or Hindu jobs, like saying Kali's tongue isn't as blue and lolling as you'd think. Those details that you feel aren't in the books, that can only come from personal interaction.
I hope you've noted some of these things down, because they need to be shared.
I know. And it's also weird, because I'm trying my best to slightly play it cool and not just desperately get him to tell me more. I'm waiting for these little sort of history bombs he talks about. I was saying to him, you know, I'm so completely in awe of you, and I don't know what to say. I've lost my words. And he said, you know, I stood in the dressing room and Thelonious Monk came off stage, and I had exactly the same feeling. And, you know, and I'm like, you've been in the room with Thelonious Monk. It's so I hope that he and I are going to try and put something together in 2021, which is a place for our sort of values and politics and vision and dream, and to build on his legacy. And we're trying to put some sort of project together, which will hopefully happen in 2021.
Wow. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for your time. I know you're a busy guy and you have so much on your plate, and as well as, you know, kids and family and stuff. So thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure having you on board. I implore anyone who's listened to this episode and listened to the musical clips to go to Pete's website and actually watch the performance. It brings a tear to my eye, certainly, and it's really, really moving. Anyway, thank you so much for your time, and I'm so glad to have you on board.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure, and thank you so much. And all your podcasts you're doing are absolutely fascinating. So I've been telling everyone to subscribe, and all of my Muso friends and non-Muso friends are hooked. So keep up doing this. Please keep up doing this amazing work yourself.
Oh, thanks so much, man. That's that means so much.
Excellent. Thank you.
You were listening to the most marvellous Pete Latanka. In the episode notes, you'll find a link to watch that live performance of Hope and Glory. I can't recommend it enough. Just seeing those young musicians giving their all is so powerful. The next episode will feature guitarist and composer Ant Law. Ant is a big inspiration for me and a hugely prominent figure on the UK jazz scene. He's released 4 albums under his own name and works regularly with saxophone legend Tim Garland and trio HLK featuring Dame Evelyn Glennie. Tune in on the 16th of March to hear from this monster musician. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to keep in touch, visit us at soundspring.co.uk. You can connect with us on Instagram by searching for Soundspring Pod, or you can send us an email at soundspringpodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. If you like what you've heard, please spread the word, and don't forget to give us a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. It really helps us to reach new listeners. If you enjoy the show and want to support our podcast, you can donate or become a patron of the show at patreon.com/soundspringpodcast. Obviously, we encourage you to go and buy our guests' music. But once you've done that, and only once you've done that, you can also stream most of the music featured in the show by searching for the Soundspring Podcast playlist in Spotify. And finally, I'd like to thank Katie Stevenson for her beautiful artwork. Please go and follow her work on social media by searching for Cub and Bloom. This is Tommy Andrews, signing off. Until next time.
Brilliant. Sorry if I talk too much.